There is one lady here. Hi. I'm Connie. I am an alcoholic. It's good to be here. It's funny, we came in and I'm compulsively early when I'm speaking. And you guys were having a business meeting and you're going over conference concerns. That is the second time in the past week that I have listened to conference concerns and sat in a business meeting. So it's awesome to hear that you guys do that. Clearly, somebody is going to the assembly and y'all are active in service. And that tells me that's a good, strong home group. That's awesome. So my sobriety date is September 19th, 2012. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women in this program, and I have a home group. And when Billy asked me where I was from, and I said Hanover, I think that's the first time that I've introduced myself as being from Hanover. I'm actually born and raised in Richmond, Virginia, and spent the first 12 years of my sobriety in Richmond, getting sober and going to meetings there. And then 2 years ago, my husband and I moved just 30 minutes north of Richmond into Hanover County, and my home group is now in the town of Ashland. And so, full transparency, I'm actually from Hanover now, not Richmond. And I don't know why that's so hard for me to say, but I guess I should get real and get honest about it. So, and moving, and I'll probably talk about that when I get further into my story. Moving in sobriety is definitely challenging. A whole new set of things that I did not anticipate. So I was thinking earlier today, I mean, it's been, God, I don't know how many weeks since you asked me to speak. And I've gotten better about not focusing for that many weeks about what it is that I'm going to say. And I've learned that if I do much better if I just pray and I said a little prayer before I got up here just to help, just to God to get me out of my own way. Because I tend to stand up here and I want to say something significant or I want to say something funny or I want to, it's weighty, heavy. I don't know what I want to do. Anything but just be truthful and be myself. That's hard for me. So I said a prayer for that. But I couldn't help it a little bit this morning. And I was thinking about, all right, you probably should maybe get yourself grounded. And I was thinking about old ideas and the book refers to huge emotional displacements and thoughts and ideas that were the guiding forces of our lives. And you got to throw them aside. And I was kind of thinking about that and how that has manifested for me. Just it, absolutely amazing. And hopefully, as I tell my story, that'll kind of make sense. So, I am born and raised in Richmond, Virginia. I'm the youngest of four girls, completely normal, upper middle class family. I was raised in the Jewish faith, which kind of becomes relevant later on. Not an alcoholic in sight. Okay. I don't know why it is that I got that jackpot, but I did. And actually, I have come to be one of those alcoholics who is grateful that I am, because it led me to this way of life that I never would have found in any other way. So I'm growing up, it's the mid 1960s in Richmond, Virginia, and I'm the youngest of four girls, and I don't look anything like my family. I don't know why that is, just genetics. But my sisters are shorter than I am. My sisters have dark hair. My hair when I was little was fire engine red. It's gotten darker. They didn't have the curls, nice straight hair. And people used to say to me when I was little, I remember being in the grocery store with my mom, and they'd come up to me and say things like, "Oh, where did you come from? You know, you must be from the milkman," or something like that. And they thought they were being funny. And I guess it is kind of funny. It's also really sort of scary. And for a kid like me who already, for whatever reason, felt completely not a part of, and I cannot explain why it is that I had that feeling since the beginning of time, but I did. And so it just reinforced to me that I was different and not a part of. And so, you know, I remember when I did my first fourth step with my first sponsor, and she said, "Go back as far as you can remember." And not knowing, because I didn't read ahead and I had no other experience with AA, I went all the way back to the beginning. And for me, that was all the way back to kindergarten, which, and I didn't know if that was the right thing to do, but it seemed to me that I had resentments and feelings that went back that far. So that's where I started. And what I remember from that period of time is that feeling of being awkward and separate. It's kind of like going through life with like this sort of glass bubble around you where you can see everybody, you can interact with everybody, but there's something indescribable that just separates me from you. And I know how to show up and act the way that I need to be, but the whole time it's I'm acting and I'm uncomfortable. And to this day, I'm still kind of an introvert and really feel more comfortable by myself anyway, or at least in smaller groups. But I remember that. I remember that distinctly in kindergarten. And my sisters didn't have that. They were very social. And I had a couple friends in the neighborhood, and I was a real tomboy. And we liked to do things like ride bikes and play in the dirt and play sports. And that was kind of what I wanted to do. That was not what my sisters wanted to do. And that caused my mom a lot of stress because I didn't want to wear dresses and I didn't want to do ballet class and I didn't want to do the things that my sisters wanted to do. And my mom really wanted me to do them. And it was also right out of the gate of kind of butting heads with her. I was very close to my dad. My dad liked to watch football. And my dad was a professor at the local university. And I spent a lot of time with my dad. And I don't know why, I had that connection. And back in that time in the city of Richmond, it was 1969, and I was in kindergarten at the local public school. And I had mentioned I was raised in the Jewish faith, and up until then, I had really been insulated, right? And just, within my family and in my neighborhood, and it just so turned out the way our neighborhood was that the other families on the block were just like us. And so that's all I knew. And then I get into this environment in a public school. And I think that was part of my feeling different too, because I didn't understand. I was telling somebody the other day, my birthday's in April. And I remember when I was a kid that every year around my birthday, I got a chocolate bunny rabbit. And every year at my birthday parties, we had chocolate footballs. That's what we called them. It was not until I was a teenager that the dots connected. And I realized that my mom was buying the Easter candy on sale at the grocery store and using it for party favors. I mean, I did not know. It was just completely not part of who I was. So I'm in this environment and it feels kind of weird. Well, back then, at that time in Richmond, then they started this thing called busing, and I won't get into why that was, but they scrambled up the schools and they were sending kids and into other parts of town. And my parents got scared, and they put me in private school. And my sisters that were older, they left them alone in public school. So now I'm doing something different than the rest of my family. And the school that they chose to put me in happened to be a very, very religious Jewish school, which I think in their minds made sense, except for it made no sense because we were kind of Jewish light. And this was not. This was like, just think in your mind, whatever you know about it, your vision of the most Orthodox Jewish person. And that's where I was in school. So now all of again, I'm not a part of, I feel different, I feel separate from. And it was just a super, super awkward time in my life that the classes were small. There were a couple of years where it was just me and three or four boys. That's it, which, it's funny because I look around this room and it's predominantly men. And I think I used to be in that. It's not the way that my environment is now. And they were horrible to me. They teased me. They just, because I was tall and skinny and flat chested and had this curly red hair, my mom didn't know what to do with it. So she cut it all off. And I looked like a boy, which wasn't a thing back then. And it was awful. And I didn't have the kind of relationship with my parents or really my sisters where I could talk about it, So I kept it all inside. And I didn't even understand that it wasn't okay. It just was. And so my head was really, really busy. And I spent a lot of time comparing myself to other people and just not watching other kids and not understanding how everything looked so easy for them and everything felt so awkward for me. And that's kind of the way it was. And that was the way it was all through elementary school and through middle school. And then when high school came up, my parents got another bright idea to move me to another private school. And this time they sent me to an Episcopalian school. So they just completely flip-flopped. And here I am again in a really, really difficult time in my life. I mean, it was eighth grade is when that school started. So I was like, what, 14 years old? The most awkward time in a girl's life. And now I'm in this school again, with a group of kids that I don't know, I'm different, I'm not like them, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable. And I had one or two friends, and that was it. It was just weird. Fortunately, one of my older sisters, the one closest in age to me, she was in college. They had all moved out. It was just me at home. But she would come into town from college, and she would make sure that she took me shopping so I had the right clothes, because my mom just didn't care about that kind of thing. But she had been to that school, and she understood what I needed to look like in order to fit in, and that was hugely important for me. So she would do that. And then later on, as I got older, she also was the sister who came into town who would go out and get me a six pack of beer, because she also understood at that point in time why that was important for me. And that's kind of was like sort of like my first adventure into alcohol or anything. And I was probably like 15 years old, and I would go to parties in private schools. Kids' parents would go out of town or something, or I don't know, maybe they just didn't care. And just like, dozens of kids would flock to these parents' houses, and my sister would buy me a six pack of beer, and then I could walk in and be the cool kid with the six pack of beer. And I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't drink enough to get drunk. It was all about the image and wanting to fit in, and so it was kind of like that, through, I guess, 8th grade, 9th grade. And again, my sisters had moved, and one of them had gotten married, and another one was engaged, and the other one was in college. It was just me at home. And then the year that I turned 15, we had a tragedy in our family. My father was diagnosed with cancer. And I'd already told you I was really close to my dad, and not close at all to my mother. And so for the next year, actually, he was diagnosed when I was 14. For the next year, I was now that kid, that kid whose parent was sick. And our whole lives for that year revolved around that. My mom, both my parents, who'd sort of been, you're sort of your classic helicopter parents. We had a lot of rules in our household growing up, a lot of expectations. In fact, there was a formula to life in our family, and that was education, money, and marry the right person. And if you did those three things, you were ensured success in life. And my mother had done it, and she had this successful family with this husband and these four daughters. My older sister kind of bucked the system and married a Catholic, and they weren't too happy about that. But otherwise, she was educated and had money, so that was good. So those are the things that were drilled into my head. And my father was a professor, like I said, at the local university. So my parents, there had been a lot of, it was pretty strict growing up. I didn't get away with a whole lot. My parents were really clued into where we were and what we were doing. And there was a lot of expectations for grades, which I never made those expectations. So I was constantly a disappointment because I just was not an academically inclined kid. And so my dad gets sick, and all of a sudden, everything shifts in our family. Instead of, all this attention on me and what I'm doing, it's my mom, who's now, I think she was 50 at the time, completely focused on what's going on with my dad, and my grandmother, who lived with us as well. And they didn't get along. It was a weird dynamic. And so that was what that whole year looked like. And then at the end of that year, my father passed away. And it was strange, because even then, I remember looking at my mom. I was telling my husband about this the other day, that the level of delusion that she always believed, I think until the day the man died, that he was coming home. And she would say things to me like, well, we'll do this when your dad gets home. And I remember just looking at her and thinking, are you nuts? Like, he's not coming home, And at the age of 15, I understood that, it was so weird. But he passed away, and I turned 16, and my mom did this wonderful thing. She threw me the car keys, and then she went off to go rediscover herself, and she went back to school and got her master's degree and went and got a job. She had never worked the whole time that I was growing up, and I was 16 years old with a set of car keys, and that was fantastic. And I met a whole different group of kids in school, and I got my first boyfriend. And these kids were into to partying. They were into drinking. They were into doing other substances. And all of a sudden, I always laugh when I read Bill's story. It talks about I have arrived. That feeling of all of a sudden life is fun now. Weekends are fun. After school is fun. I have friends. We're hanging out. We're doing exciting things. We're running all over the city of Richmond, doing things we shouldn't be doing. And my mother is paying no attention to me at all. And I'm loving it. I'm loving life. And so that's kind of like what the last few years of high school looked like. And then, as is expected in my family, I had to go to college because that's what we do. And I really didn't care about where I went. So I went where my sisters went because that seemed like a good idea. It was good enough for them, it could be good enough for me. And it was a university in Washington, D.C., so in the city. And that was appealing because there's a lot going on. It's not like a campus school, right? And it's just all the whole city of D.C. and a lot going on. So I moved on up there. And immediately found the fraternities. Was not interested in sororities. I don't want to join your crazy group. I don't want to follow your rules. I don't want to be with the girls. I want to be part of a fraternity, which means being a little sister. You get to come to all the parties. So basically, you get all the benefits with none of the responsibility. So you can come to all the parties and drink all their beer and do all their other substances. And that was a blast. And that's what 4 years of college looked like. And I did manage to graduate, barely, but I did. I also managed to arrange it so that in 4 years of school, I got to keep an eye on the time, 4 years of school, I never had a Friday class. And I didn't, I don't, now I look at back on it now, it makes complete sense, right? Is that, the weekend starts Thursday night. So I always had classes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And my goal, because the way classes were, at least when I was in school, probably the same way, it was like Monday, Wednesday lecture, and then Tuesday, Thursday. That's how the classes were. My goal was to get to either the Monday or the Wednesday of that class every week. And I did have those recurring dreams, and I still occasionally get them where I wake up and I can't find the lecture hall. And I'm like running around campus and I don't know where it is because it's been so long since I've been to the class. And the truth is that that happened. Not that I couldn't find the classroom, but I do distinctly remember walking in one time and finding that we had an exam and sat down. And like a good budding alcoholic that I was, I just packed up my stuff and walked out. I was like, oh, I'll deal with that later. I'm not going to sit down and take this exam. So it's just complete irresponsibility. But trying to make it look okay for my family, right? I'm supposed to do the things. And I was still dating that guy from high school, sort of, along with various assorted other men or young men in school. And my family did not like him at all because he didn't meet the specifications. And I got a lot of flack from my mom about that, a whole lot. And a lot of comments about why it was that she could send me to a university that was predominantly Jewish, and yet I could find every non-Jew on campus to date. But it's just, I didn't want to follow the rules, but these are what the rules are, and this is what's guaranteed for success. So I graduate from college, and it never occurs to me in all that time that I have any kind of problem with drinking or other substances because I had surrounded myself with kids who were doing exactly the same thing. And I didn't have any consequences. I never got arrested and get a DUI and nothing bad happened. I did graduate, and so it just never occurred to me. It was just like that's just what college was and high school was, and it was fun and I enjoyed it and I had a great time. And now I'm graduated and now I moved back to Richmond and it's time to start adulting. And it occurred to me that I wasn't going to be able to adult if I was still doing those childish things. And that's really what I thought they were. And so I got rid of that boyfriend. I met a new one who fit the family qualifications. And understand, this is nothing that I understood at the time. Okay. It sounds so crass and harsh. I understand it now in retrospect what I was doing. At the time, he just seemed like the right kind of guy. His family was educated, he had money, he was right faith, checked all the boxes. This is the guaranteed success that the path that I'm supposed to take, the rules that I'm supposed to follow. And now I'm ready to leave behind all that, childish stuff that I did and get on with life. And I want a family, I want to get married, I want children, I want all those things. And so I set out on a mission to get all those things, and I got all those things. We got the right house in the right neighborhood. I immediately started having children. I have three children, and they were all born within 4 years. So boom, 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 really close together. Seemed like a good idea at the time. I also worked full time, which I did not understand why I was required to do that. We had enough money. I didn't need to. But he told me I'd be boring if I didn't go to work because he didn't think that staying home and taking care of kids was exciting enough. And so I worked full time. My kids were in daycare and life was crazy and chaotic. Just absolutely complete unmanageability. And I did not do any drugs. I didn't do any drinking. I had put all that down when I got out of college. And it wasn't like I was white knuckling it. It just left me, in favor of this other thing. And there's a story in the big book about that too, about the businessman who decides to like put it all aside, and then it comes back later. And whenever I read that story, it gives me the heebie-jeebies because I mean that's the truth. And so I wasn't doing anything then, but I was working full time. I had these three really busy kids, and my then husband had his own company and his own business and was completely disinterested in anything that we were doing as a family and was never around. So it was just me and three kids. And this is when alcohol starts to come back into my life. And again, I didn't think I had any problem. It never occurred to me. There's no alcoholics in my family. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I had that by then it had probably been, I don't know, 10 years since I'd had a drink or another substance. I mean, it just not interested. And what was happening is that at night, after I got the kids to bed, and I would start to clean up the kitchen and do laundry, and I would think, it'd be really nice to have a glass of wine while I do this. Not thinking anything of it. I had all kinds of rules. It's only going to be after the kids go to bed. I would never drink and drive, it's just purely this. And it started out with like box of wine in the refrigerator. Kids go to bed. I have a glass of wine. Then what happens, because we all know this is a progressive thing, it slowly starts to get more. Instead of waiting until the kids go to bed, well, they're old enough now, they're not going to drown in the bathtub. I can run from room to room and get them all into bed and I can have a drink. And then it kind of got to where the wine really wasn't cutting it. I think maybe I'd really like a vodka tonic at night, and so I sort of switched to vodka. Still all kinds of rules about, not drinking and driving. And it kept creeping. And it's like that those bars that we just keep lowering and lowering. And life is frantic and crazy and busy, and I'm working full time and the kids and all this, and I'm not paying any attention to what's happening. And my marriage, meanwhile, is really starting to disintegrate. And what happened, several years of it looking like that. And then in 2006, so I got sober in 2012. In 2006, I found out that my husband was having an affair. And that was like it for me. That was when the wheels came off. That was just it was kind of probably, now I look at it, probably like just a good excuse, because things weren't good before then. But it just, I felt terribly sorry for myself. I quit my job. I told him I was never going to work another day in my life. And I became a stay-at-home mom, which is a beautiful thing for an alcoholic. And my goal every day became to get him out the door, my kids on the bus, and then I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And what that looked like was a couple of shots of tequila, because I had moved from vodka to tequila by then, in my morning coffee, and get the kids on the bus. And then I would drink literally until I passed out. I would always set an alarm though for like 1 o'clock in the afternoon so that I'd get up, take a shower, throw in a couple loads of laundries, though, that when I got the kids off the bus, it looked like mom had actually been doing something all day instead of drinking. And then I loaded all the kids in the car and we went out to go do the kid things, which for my kids was soccer and horseback riding and all this kind of stuff. And then I became that mom. I'm the mom that's dropping kids off at soccer fields, and I'm a big fan of little airplane bottles, and I got them in the glove compartment in the center console. I got them in my backpack, and I'm dropping kids off at soccer fields. And I'm opening up bottles of tequila and tossing them back. And my GPS, because this is like back in the days of Garmin, looked like this circuit of ABC stores interspersed with soccer fields. And I had rules about not going to the same ABC store more than once a week because you don't want the people who work there to get to know you. And I had, meanwhile, at home, I had gallons of alcohol because the little ones were just for, while I was out in public, doing things that you think about it now. I mean, in the restroom stall at the kids' elementary school with the little teeny toilet, and I'm in there unscrewing one and like shaking, tossing. I'm in the kids' elementary school before a parent teacher meeting. It's nuts the things that we do in the grocery store. I had also switched to drinking peppermint schnapps during the day because I felt like it would smell like a breath mint. Well, those bottles, they get stuck. The tops get like the sugar in it. And so you're in a restroom stall and I don't understand what's happening to me, the shaking and the sweating. Okay, I'm starting to, I don't understand that, but I can't get darn top off the thing, and I'm putting it in my mouth and trying to crank it open, and it's like I'm gonna break my teeth, and I can't go out and turn on the hot water and run it under the hot water, right? Says because somebody might see me. So then I started like pre-opening them. I was smart before I left the house so that that would not happen, so that I'd be okay when I got out. So I mean, it's just absolute madness, the fact that I didn't get a DUI and didn't have an accident and kill my children, somebody else's children, it is absolutely unbelievable. But that's the truth of it. And so I'm drinking all day, every day now. This is what it looks like. But I'm a big fan of maintenance level drinking. I'm not a sloppy drunk, and I have never had a blackout. I know exactly how much I need to drink to get the effect that I want. And I will coast along like that until about 9 o'clock at night, and then all bets are off, and I'll just drink myself right into bed. I don't have an exciting drunkalogue. When I go to speaker meetings, and I love to go and sit and listen to people, and they're funny, the stories, and it's funny because you read that little, those paragraphs before, and it talks about our stories not being in good taste, and I don't have anything to tell you that's really not in good taste. I mean, I didn't, that was not what my drinking looked like. It was just sad and lonely and pathetic. It was me by myself just trying to get through a day. I had to go back to work in 2011 because he told me I had to, and we needed health insurance. And so I did. And I remember thinking, because I had had a whole career prior to that, but it had been now several years since I'd worked in that career. And I thought, oh my God, where am I going to work? How am I going to find a job? Is it going to be in that career? I was looking at like being a barista at Starbucks. I mean, something, anything. And I'm drinking all day, every day. How is that going to work? And by some sequence of events, which is an absolute God thing, I ended up getting in touch with an old boss, and I got a job. He gave me a job. He remembered me from years before when I was not an al drinking alcoholically, and said, yeah, we could actually use you. And I got a fantastic job, which I have to this day, that job. And I remember getting dressed and ready for work that first day, and it was like, you can't drink, and what I had done prior to that is gone to see my primary care physician, and I gotten a prescription for Valium, not understanding that it's exactly the same thing, but I can pop a Valium in the morning before I go to work. And that's kind of what I did, and I made it for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months of not drinking during the day and waiting until I got home. And then, because this is a progressive thing and it always gets worse, it never gets better, I couldn't wait until I got home. And so I started cracking open the bottle in the car in the parking lot of the office. And then it got so where I couldn't wait until 5 o'clock in the parking lot of the office. And it was 3 o'clock in the ladies' room. And I'm back now to peppermint schnapps, which, by the way, is like 110 proof, too. So it's really good stuff. And then I couldn't make it till 3. Then it was noon. And after, I don't know, maybe 9 months, I'm back to where I'm drinking all day, every day. And I'm showing up for work. And because I'm a maintenance level drinker, I can get by. And because I'm a woman of a certain age, I can put a fan on my desk and turn it on and complain that I'm having hot flashes when the truth is that I'm detoxing. I just don't understand anything about that. And so, that was like, 2008, well, 2011. And I should backtrack for a minute because in 2006, we had, or in 2008, we had briefly ended up in marriage counseling because I didn't leave him after he had the affair, which was really dumb. But anyway, and my drinking came up during the marriage counseling, and it was proposed to me that maybe I should take a look at that. And I was convinced that he was the problem. And side note, he also had developed a huge dependence on prescription opioids. But again, I'm completely naive. I grew up in this sheltered environment. He was getting them from a physician. I had no idea. But basically, my kids were growing up with an addict and an alcoholic under one roof, is what it really was going on. So I went to a handful of AA meetings and decided you guys were religious freaks. And besides, your story sounded a lot worse than mine. Y'all had lost your jobs, you had lost your cars, your houses, you had DUIs, you'd been locked up. I was nothing like you all. No, thank you. And after a handful of meetings, I left. I think I did an IOP. I had to do it twice because I kept flunking. But that also, it did nothing for me. And I just went back to what I was doing. So fast forward, here it is. Now it's early 2012, and I'm starting to get scared because what's happening is I'm overshooting the mark now. So that maintenance level drinking that I had mastered so well, in the morning, instead of having one shot with my coffee, I was having two or three. And by, getting out the door at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm already pretty tight, and I know it. And that's not good. And I'm also thinking about going ahead and filing for divorce. And I'm like, I really should probably be clear-headed if I'm going to do that. And I was really afraid that I was going to get busted at work, that at some point somebody was going to figure it out, and I could not afford to lose my job. And this is one of those things where they tell us ego is so much to our detriment, it, but in this case, ego was probably what saved me, and that the fear of getting found out, of that humiliation. I decided it was better to tell them than to let them approach me. And so I went to my boss and I said, I got a drinking problem. And she said, you got to be kidding me. You're fine. You're at work every day. You do your work is perfect. And I'm like, I'm high functioning. I had to get very graphic and tell her about drinking in the ladies' room and all kinds of stuff. I ended up through the company employee assistance program going to a therapist. And for the first time in my life, I actually got honest with somebody. It was the very first time in my life where I truly, this woman, I had been to other therapists before. I had shown up drunk in their office. I'd always told them what I wanted to them to hear. I thought, they wanted to hear. This woman, I was honest with her, and told her, and she was very, very good. And she worked on me for a couple of months, and it's funny because I'm showing up to her office for an appointment drunk. And I'm thinking that she doesn't notice, and she's like, go home. There's nothing we can do here today. And I'm, she kept wanting me to go to treatment. I'm like, I can't go to treatment. I got three kids. I got a job. I got a husband who was completely worthless. I cannot go to treatment. I can't go to treatment. I can't go. What I ended up doing was waking up one morning and driving myself to the local detox in the local hospital, Tucker's Pavilion and Chippenham Hospital, if you're familiar with the Richmond area. I literally got in the car and drove myself one day. I don't know what it was about that day that made me do that. I can tell you that up the months leading up to that, I wasn't suicidal, but I was definitely kind of like Bill talks about, having to move his mattress down to the lower floor because he's afraid he's going to jump out the window. I was having these weird compulsions where I was driving in the car, not with my kids in the car, but by myself, and wondering what would happen if I just jerked the steering wheel. It's like, so I'm not contemplating suicide, but then I kind of became afraid that, and I understand what Bill's talking about, that this compulsion was going to take over me and I wouldn't be able to control it, And I was kind of okay with the idea of dying because, after all, my own father died when I was 15, and look how I turned out. My kids don't need me, right? And the youngest one, was, I don't know, he was what, 15, 16, 15. And the older two, and then they can drive him around and they'll have dad, even though he sleeps all day and stays up all night. And I don't know what it was about that morning that I woke up and decided that I didn't want to die. And I also recognized very clearly that he and I, we were both going to die, and my kids were going to end up being orphans. I mean, and that was no joke, and I knew it. And so I checked myself into detox and I stayed 3 days. And the folks from AA showed up while I was in detox and they walked in. And I'm like, it's the people from AA. It's the religious nuts. It's the people with all the tragic stories. And, you know, and it's funny because I had no idea what detox was going to be. I just thought it was going to be like mom's vacation. Like I was going to lay in a hospital bed and watch TV and they were going to bring me food. I don't know if you've ever been on one of those places, but it is not like that at all. There's these little beds, they do not recline. There's no TV on the wall. They don't bring you food. You know, you have to go to classes. And oh my gosh, I thought I have made a huge mistake. But I also remember this overwhelming realization that the sum total of my life's experiences, all that careful calculation, those years of following the rules of doing exactly what it was that my family, once I got beyond college, doing what my family told me to do that was guaranteed a success. And here I am in a bed in a detox facility with a bunch of people that look like you. And I'm like, that math just made no sense to me, how that could be. And I was like, okay, you know, something's not right here. So the folks from AA come in, and it was two young women, much younger than I am, whose stories didn't sound anything like mine at all. They had great drunkalogues. And I don't know what it was that I heard. And how it was, other than a God thing, that I was able to put aside my other ideas that I had about AA and sit and listen to these two women. But I heard something that they had to say. And what I understood was the feelings of being separate from and being a part, not a part of, and that disconnect between me and you and the decisions that you make. And it's just no God in it and complete full, you know, self-will and just a total unmanageability. It's just unmanageability looks different for different people, you know. And they said that they had a home group. It was the Speaking of Steps group, and that it met on Sundays and Wednesdays, and that they would be there. And I got discharged from the detox on Saturday and decided that I would go to AA, but I wasn't going to go that day because I woke up in detox. So technically, I'd done recovery that day. And so I didn't need to go to a meeting. But the next day was Sunday. And I was going to go to that meeting where those two women were. And I always say this when I share, if you're a member of a home group and you have the opportunity to do that kind of service work, you know, in treatment, or you meet a newcomer somewhere and you tell them that you're going to be at a certain meeting at a certain time, please be there. Because I walked into that meeting, and that meeting at that time on Sunday was huge. It was over 100 people, and I was scared out of my mind. And I looked around the room, and those two women were there. And I don't think if they had been there, I probably would have turned around and walked out, you know. But they were there, and I ran up to them, and I was like, "Oh my God, I met you at Tucker's," you know. And I understand now from being on the other side of it that that is the most awesome feeling when you meet somebody in that kind of environment and they actually come to get help. It's just like the realization that you said something that registered with somebody that made a difference. It's, you know, hopefully they do get sober. And to this day, I still see those two women. It's just amazing. And they did exactly what it is that you're supposed to do. You know, they gave me phone numbers. They introduced me to other women in AA. And those women completely surrounded me. I was like, y'all are way too friendly. You are crowding me. They're texting me. They're calling me. And it's just weird. And I sort of had this feeling that, if it felt weird and awkward, it was probably good for me, you know? And so I'm just going to go with it, even though it is a complete 180 from anything I would have done at any time prior to that in my life. I was still living with my then husband, but we were going through the divorce process. I just didn't have another place to live. So it was weird. Life was like getting up, going to work, going to AA meetings, staying out as late as I possibly could, coming home, going to sleep just to avoid him and all that stuff, and until I found a place to live, and I did. Meanwhile, all the women are going, get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. I don't, it sounds so childish. A sponsor, get a home group. It's like homeroom in elementary school. I don't want to do these things. But they were on me. And the other thing was that the Wednesday meeting for my home group at that time had this ritual where at the beginning of the meeting, they went around and you introduced yourself, your name, sobriety date, and when you last talked to your sponsor. And a lot of people don't like that. But in my case, I understand why the group does it because it sure worked on me. I didn't want to be the person that was like, I don't have a sponsor. So I picked the scariest woman in the room and walked up and asked her to be my sponsor. And I did that on purpose because I am my character, one of my many character defects is overconfidence. Okay. And I am definitely not one that suffers from problems with, self-image or anymore. Okay. I mean, I did as a kid, but inner alcohol and other substances, that completely went away. And I tend to judge women very harshly. And I knew that I needed somebody that seemed bigger than me, somebody that I would listen to, somebody who could tell me this is the way it needs to be. Because if I judge you and decide that I know more than you, I'm not going to listen to you. And so I needed to be a little a bit intimidated, and she was quite intimidating. And she became my sponsor. And she asked me three questions: Are you done? Are you willing to go to any lengths? And will you agree to sponsor other women when we get through with the 12 steps? And I answered yes. I had no idea what I was answering yes to, but I wanted this woman to be my sponsor, so I said yes. And so we sat down, and I met with her every week, and she read to me, which I was highly insulted because I'm a college graduate. Why are you reading to me out of this thing? But she did. And I told her that we could skip the chapter We Agnostics because I was not agnostic. I believed in God for sure. I always had had a belief in God. I just didn't believe that God had anything to do with me in my life, but I believed in God and therefore not an agnostic. And she said, no, we're going to read that chapter. And as it turns out, that's probably my most favorite chapter now. And we literally started, my book is over there, but we started, like she drew like on this page, like we started here. We read all the forewords, as boring as they are, everything on the first 164 pages, we read it all. She did not read the sto personal stories in the back. She left me to do that on my own. But we did that, and I got a home group, and I got a service position in that home group, and I started doing the things. And life got so good. Life is still so good. And for somebody who didn't want to come to AA, for somebody who walked in here and judged all of you so harshly, really in a relatively short period of time, the sense of belonging and fellowship and connection is something that I cannot describe, and for me on a Sunday evening to drive up here with my new husband and be in a meeting full of you all who I've never met before and feel that sense of okayness and acceptance and to be able to stand up here and just, tell those things that, maybe are not in good taste, I don't know, and be okay with doing that, and that is something that I never had my growing up. And my older sisters, I remember early on in sobriety, they were so funny because they would come to visit and we'd go out for dinner and they'd be like, oh, I can't go into that restaurant, there's a bar. And I'm like, I can go in there, it's not like the alcohol is gonna leap over the table. And like, the obsession to drink left me the day that I walked out of that detox facility. I cannot explain it. I do not understand how I can go from being an all-day, everyday drinker, spending 3 days in detox and walking out and it's gone and it's never returned at all. And it's not that life hasn't shown up in situations which would make a normal person drink, let alone an alcoholic. They have for me. But it's just, it's gone and I cannot explain it. And my sisters would say to me, why are you still going to AA? Aren't you sober like, a year now or 2 years now? And trying to get somebody who's a non-alcoholic to understand what it is that I have found here. And that sense that, it talks about, a way of living. I don't know, we can't paraphrase the book, but it makes sense basically. A way where I can be at least sane, if not always serene. I have a lot of serenity, but at least sane through life. I can have meaningful relationships. I have a sense of purpose. I can walk, go anywhere, and do anything. And life is fantastic. I have this beautiful relationship with my three children. I now have a stepson. I have a great relationship with him. I have grandchildren now, which is the coolest thing. We went yesterday, the youngest one, I have twins. that are five, and then the youngest one just turned a year old. And you know, you talk about life showing up and things that would make a normal person drink. In the what 13 years that I've been sober, that former husband committed suicide, intentional drug overdose. You know, get through that with my kids. My daughter got married. I got married. My mother died. Like I said, I didn't have a great relationship with her anyway, but she did, and it's still traumatic. My daughter had these twins that were born at 25 weeks. And if any of you all are, y'all have children and understand that pregnancies are 40 weeks, babies born at 25 weeks don't have a real good chance. And these two are beautiful 5-year-olds. But walking through that was probably of all those things that I listed off that could happen, was absolutely the most terrifying feeling of powerlessness and fear that I have had in my entire life. And I got through that because of AA. I got through that because of my sponsor, of going to meetings, of working with my sponsees, of doing service work, all the things that intuitively tell me that no, I shouldn't do. I should be focusing on me. And instead, it's like, no, that when, and I have found that when things get crazy, more AA is better for me than less AA. It is complete counterintuitive thinking to how I was down. Now it is not counterintuitive. Now I intuitively know where I need to be and what I need to do. It is absolutely amazing. There was something else I wanted to share. And now it's we were talking about it before the meeting. It's like, uh-oh, it's just going to leave me. What life looks like. You know, it is absolutely just a remarkable thing. It's also, I'm at the point in my life, and this happened actually for me pretty early on, that you can't separate me from AA anymore. It's not like there's Connie and then there's Connie's recovery. And I had a very arrogant attitude when I first got sober that, you know, I was more than an alcoholic. I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a this, I'm a that. And it was like going to be this thing that I was going to do a couple nights a week. And after a very short period of time, it really has permeated me. And, you know, the book talks about practicing these principles in all of our affairs. And that is absolutely true for me. It is true for me in my relationships and my family. It is true for me in my marriage. It is true for me in my job. You know, it is a way of living. You know, I'm a big believer in 10, 11, and 12, 10, 11, and 12. You know, I was raised in a sponsorship family that believes that. I don't have to go all the way back to one. It's 10, 11, and 12 now. And so what I try to do is sort of stay focused on that. And the 10th step for me looks like a very, some days I'm better at it than others. I do start the morning with an 11th step, but the problem with me and the 11th step is that as soon as I pray to God to, you know, do your will, and then I get up, it's gone. And I've walked out the door, and now it's all back to me and my will. And God help me if I pray for things to go any kind of certain way that I want them to, you know, that's just asking for trouble. And so I do start the day with just saying, basically, God help. That just help me. Whatever happens today, just help me. And most days I'm pretty good at just sort of a watchful eye on what I know my character defects are, or at least how they manifest. I know I can't necessarily tell you if I'm being resentful or dishonest or, you know, whatever the character defect, but I can tell you if I'm feeling flushed or my blood pressure is rising or my heart rate is going up or I'm getting the compulsion to raise my voice or fire off that nasty email. Those I can pick up on, and that's when I know that's pause. Okay, walk away, you know, do what you got to do. So, you know, that's 10, 11 right there for me. And then 12 is, you know, it's this kind of stuff. It's sponsorship, it's service work, it's having a home group. I mean, it's all these things, and it is not a burden anymore. And it really never has. It has just become part of who I am. And I wouldn't want to leave it at this point. I think my life would be so empty without it. And, it's a beautiful thing. And I think that I am done now. So thank you. Thank you.